Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Amanda Matty, author of A Foreign Affair, A True Story of Love and War, a memoir which chronicles her 2005 deployment to Iraq and how she met her husband, a Baghdad native who served as her translator. My guest's second novel, Voicing the Eagle, is a prequel to her memoir and will be released in 2017. Welcome, Amanda. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's begin a long time ago with your deployment to Baghdad as a Navy intelligence analyst. What was that job to be like, and what were your first impressions of the land and its people?
Well, I deployed in May, so my first impressions of the land was that it was hot.
Right.
It was very hot. But the people were warm, they were kind, they were welcoming. They were excited for us to be there, from what I could tell, the people that I interacted with. And they were really eager to share their culture with us. They were constantly inviting us to eat with them. So it was a lot of fun, and it felt more like a foreign exchange program than going to war. So I guess I was lucky in that respect. As far as my job, ironically enough, my official job title was Foreign Affairs Relations Officer.
How ironic.
I worked for the NSA at the time. Even though I was in the Navy, I worked for the NSA as well. And I was over there basically working for them. And we were rebuilding the Iraqi National Intelligence Service. Just like most everything in Iraq, the U.S. had just disassembled everything. So we were building everything back up from the ground up. So the intelligence service was one of the things that the CIA and the NSA really wanted to get built back up so that the Iraqis could help themselves, so that they could send actionable intelligence and collect intelligence and send it to their troops on the ground. So we were building that back up. And when I say from the ground up, I mean we went over there and had to start from the basics of teaching them, the new employees, what classified material was, how you're supposed to mark it, how you're supposed to handle it, how you're supposed to protect it, how you're supposed to destroy it. So we were really teaching them everything from the ground up. And a lot of them were new hires, because the CIA went in and, of course, hired newbies. They did hire back a lot of the old intelligence officers that worked under Saddam. So there was, you know, some leadership in there and some experienced Iraqis who had worked in the intelligence field before. So a lot of them were newly hired employees with absolutely no background in intelligence work or even government work. So again, we were training them from the ground up, but training them in the intelligence field was kind of just half of the job. The other half of the job was foreign relations. We were there to build relationships. We were there to build trust. We wanted them to look at the Americans as friends, as allies. We were there to help them.
Right.
So part of the job, one of the first things my boss said to me when I got off the plane was, smile, be engaging. We're here to mingle. We're here to build trust. At the time, the U.S. had full control of the country still, of course, but we knew the time was coming that we were going to be handing the reins over to the Iraqi government. And then they would have the power basically to tell all of us, pack up and go home. So what we were trying to do was kind of embed ourselves, trying to woo them, if you will, to basically invite us to stay along, to stay on after they took over control and have us help them. And we wanted them to want us to be there. So that was basically more my job than the actual training them in intelligence. I had only been in the intelligence field 3 years myself. I was no expert. So I was great at foreign relations, though.
But you were using your translator for that, for the foreign relations.
Exactly.
And for the teaching as well.
Exactly. Because, of course, most of the Iraqis who worked at the INIS did not speak English. And I did not speak any Arabic. I was actually a Russian linguist.
Wow.
And they didn't speak Russian either. So.
No, I don't think so.
So we definitely had, you know, a lot of translators that worked in our specific little department. And Fadi was one of those translators.
And so love happened. I think the thing that strikes me is that we're always drawn to romantic stories, love that grows despite the incredible odds. You know, we love Romeo and Juliet and West Side Story. And so here you are in Iraq, and When did you realize that he was going to be your one great love?
For us, it was actually the cliched love at first sight. Really? It really was. I know I'm a hopeless romantic, but here we are 10 years later, 11 years later. It really was. Maybe more so for him, because honestly, I really don't even remember the first time we met, because it had been a whirlwind of introductions for me. It was like my second night in the country. It was my first night working at the building. We called it the building. My boss had taken me pretty much from office to office to office and introduced me to dozens and dozens of new faces. All these foreign names were flying at me. I shook a lot of hands, and the translator office was, I believe, actually the last office that they took us to. Mm-hmm. So by that time, everything was a blur. Fadi remembers. If you asked him, he remembers our first meeting. He actually kind of had to refresh my memory when I was writing the book about our first meeting.
So what sticks out in your mind as what you remember?
The actual time I knew was only about an hour later after we met. He knew at first as well. When he first saw me, he knew. Something just clicked. And he spent the next hour in his office with his buddy trying to figure out a way to make up an excuse to come over to the American office just so he could see me again, he said. So he came up with something, knocked on the door of our office, and then started chit-chatting with one of my colleagues. His name was Keith, and they were buddies already. Keith had been in country for a couple months. So he came over and struck up a conversation with Keith. And that's really the first memory I have of Fadi. And the feeling, honestly, it's indescribable. It really is. I knew then, he knew then. It was unbelievable. He went back to his office, sat down, and told his buddy, his fellow translator, I'm going to marry that girl.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So the French call that the coup de foudre, the lightning bolt.
That's definitely what it was.
Okay, so you met him, you somehow knew, you had that intuition, he had it right away, and then I imagine that it just continued to grow and to blossom, and it wasn't a very romantic environment. So what were the conflicts, the inevitable conflicts that happened when you fell in love with your Iraqi translator?
Everything in Iraq went pretty smoothly, actually. I was only 22 years old. I was naive. I honestly did not understand how risky of a relationship this was, that it was not going to be looked upon, you know, very nicely by anybody, that my government, the people I worked for, were not going to be happy about this at all. Having worked at the NSA for 3 years, I knew numerous people who worked there who had foreign spouses. So to me, it didn't seem like that much of an issue. As a matter of fact, like I said, when I got there, I was told, these are our friends. We liberated these people there. I thought we were gonna hold hands and sing kumbaya till the end of time. That's what we're supposed to do. So the fact that Fadi and I might be developing a relationship, to me, it didn't seem like that big of a deal.
So when did you know? What was the first thing that happened?
As far as when I knew that,
that all was not going to be well.
That it was not going to go too well.
Right.
Honestly, another lightning bolt. After being in country for 4 months, I was sitting at the office on our base in the green zone at the time. We had a satellite office. And I was sitting at the computer when these two people walked up behind me and said, for your safety, we're ejecting you from the country.
Really?
Yeah. And I was, excuse me? What do you mean for my safety? You're ejecting me from the country. Oh, it's come to our attention that you're having an inappropriate relationship with an Iraqi national. And for your safety, we're going to escort you. And they literally escorted me from the office to my room on base, watched me pack, made sure I didn't have any access to any communication devices, took any cell phones I had, took my computer, took me to the helicopter landing zone, escorted me onto the chopper. A woman CIA agent sat with me. They flew me to Baghdad International Airport, and then that same female CIA agent escorted me onto a C-130 plane to Jordan. And once I landed in Jordan, they did let me go on my own, but they handed me a commercial airline ticket back to DC. When I landed at Dulles, there were NSA agents and Navy personnel from my unit there that escorted me home.
So from your perspective now, if it's not a spoiler, was it for your own safety?
I think they believe it really was.
Mm-hmm.
I was young.
Right.
They didn't know what Fadi's intentions were. But the thing was that ultimately that I found that it was a pretty bad double standard. Had I been a male having an inappropriate relationship with a female, this would have never happened. It would have never been, oh, we're ejecting you from the country and going to escort you home for your safety. For some reason, whenever a female falls in love with a foreigner, they think any kind of emotional attachment automatically, national secrets are going to fall out of her mouth.
Okay. So it would compromise.
Right. Exactly. You know, we're just emotional creatures and you might not know, but he's manipulating you and you're too naive to understand it. And of course, obviously none of that had happened. I knew that if Fadi and I were going to pursue a relationship in the future, that there would be steps that I would have to take in order to safeguard. I mean, the fact that I had a top secret security clearance. Anytime you have a relationship with a foreigner, there are steps and protocols that you have to follow. And I was fully prepared and ready to follow those steps and protocols. So then when I ended up in this horrible mess, I honestly didn't understand. Like, why is this happening to me?
Must have been very upsetting.
It was a really rough year. Let's just say that.
So you found yourself at the center of an international criminal investigation. Tell us a little bit about that at its peak, again, without a spoiler, and maybe what toll it had on your relationship.
Fadi's and my relationship has really never faltered. It did not have much of an effect on our relationship. We were both, of course, stressed to the max over it. Mm-hmm. When I returned to D.C., I, of course, was stripped of my clearance immediately, and then I was stuck in an interrogation room with an NSA agent, an NCIS agent, and a CIA investigative agent, and I was interrogated for 8 hours a day over the course of probably about a 4-day period.
Oh.
And they were just, of course, they played the nice, you know, you just might not understand what he's tried to get out of you. And they kept trying to just see what all I had told this Iraqi guy that was manipulating me and that I didn't know who he was. And so they were trying to definitely, I think, make a name for themselves. They were going to be the heroes that nabbed, you know, the espionage girl.
Did you ever doubt him for one second?
Never. I knew him from the moment I looked in his eyes. I knew who he was and what he was. But I can see from the outside looking back.
Sure.
I mean, yeah, definitely. I totally understand. However, they did try to railroad me. They, of course, like I said, they used the whole, you just don't understand that he's manipulating you. They typed up my confession and laid it in front of me. Just sign here and all of this will be over. Luckily, something inside me said, don't sign anything. Because
right.
In the end, I did later find out that that was basically, that would have been the nail in the coffin for me. That confession that was in that paper would have court-martialed me for mishandling of classified information.
Wow. So how long did this process take?
Almost a full year. I ended up back, I got ejected from Iraq the very end of August. The investigation remained open, clear through until May of the following year. And of course, it was hell for me, literally, because I was looked at when I came back to my command there. I was looked at by all of my fellow sailors as just this awful person who had been sleeping with the enemy.
So you were falsely accused, in
yes,
a sense.
Yes, I was looked at as I was dirty, I was low. How could you do this? Think of all of your fellow military members that are over there bleeding for this country, and you're over there sleeping around with the enemy who we're fighting, who's killing our boys. Even upper enlisted members of the command would look at me and say things that were not good. I'd have senior chiefs that are, of course, you know, upper enlisted Navy members that would come up to me and say, out of 300 million Americans, you have to choose an Iraqi. Shameful.
So this was a very painful experience. So how did it lead to your exit from the military, and how long did it take for him to come to this country, if that's something that you'd like to share on the radio?
Well, luckily, we both stood our ground. He was being interrogated in Iraq by agents simultaneously as
Another
I was.
Another painful experience,
right.
I would imagine.
Yes, he was being interrogated over there as well. Then, of course, once they weren't able to get any evidence against us for doing anything that they could legally pursue us, then, of course, they just tried to do anything they could to break us up. They were telling me stories about him. They were telling him all these false stories about me. Oh, you know, when she landed back in America, she went back to her boyfriend. Mm-hmm. She doesn't think about you anymore. It was just all kinds of just games and head games and mind games to do anything they could to break us off. My commander made me sign a no contact order saying that I would not have any sort of communication with Fadi. And in the end, that was the only thing they were able to get me for, because I did sign that. And then I did have contact with him. I said, you're not going to tell me who I can love. And so luckily in the end, that's all they were able to get me for. They did do a disciplinary review board on me for breaking the no contact order. And it basically was just a chance for everybody to lay into me again about how awful, what an awful person I was for sleeping with an Iraqi.
Well, with all that, I imagine it would have been very, very difficult to get him to come here.
Well, like I said, at the end of the investigation, I was smart enough to seek out a civilian lawyer.
Good idea.
That was completely outside of the military. After day four of these intense interrogations, I mean, even though I was naive and I was young, man, I grew up fast. Mm-hmm. I matured and I did my research real quick and said, something's not right here. I need to protect myself. I'm going to end up in Leavenworth if I don't take some action here. So I did. I drove into DC, pursued a civilian lawyer who was experienced in military trials. And I was being watched, obviously, because literally the next day, the interrogation stopped. The investigators didn't contact me anymore. The case remained open, and they said, oh, we're working on it, we're working on it, we're working on it. I think what they were trying to do is they were trying to drag it out, though, because they knew they didn't have anything on me. I hadn't done anything wrong. So they were like, well, we're just going to keep the investigation open, keep these two apart. Hopefully the relationship will disintegrate. I had about a year left on my enlistment, so they were going to at least keep it open, hopefully, till the end of the enlistment. Finally, there was nothing. They couldn't do anything. NSA was the first ones that actually closed the investigation. Like, we've got bigger things to worry about. This girl didn't do anything. So NSA closed it and dropped it. And then when they closed it and dropped it, the NCIS tried to keep it open and keep pursuing me. And from what I hear, rumor, of course, I don't have anything official. NSA basically told NCIS, just get her out of the Navy. Just get rid of her. Stop this. If you take it any further, we don't know what might come out. If you do try to court-martial her, if something has to become a public trial, and we really don't want that stuff out there.
Sure.
She's not worth it. So they finally dropped it. I was called to the legal office on base, and they basically said, okay, the investigation is closed, but we just would really like you out of our Navy. And I said, I'd really like out of your Navy, too, because you're definitely not what I thought you were.
Do you think you would have stayed in the military if all this hadn't happened? Made it a career?
I probably would have. I still have friends from boot camp, you know, 16 mm-hmm. years ago who are still in. I follow them on Facebook. I see them in their Navy careers. And it is, you know, like, hey, look what I gave up on, or look what I lost out on. But then I also look at my beautiful kids and my awesome husband, mm-hmm. and I think, oh, I won in the end.
Yeah, it really is a fairy tale. It has a happily ever after ending. How often do we get that? And as you state on your website, so I know I'm not giving any spoilers here, that you've got your family now with your two girls, 1-9 and 1-2.
Yep.
So take us to that present day life. What are the joys and challenges 11 years later?
Honestly, I think our life is about as idyllic as you can get. I've got two beautiful, healthy little girls. Fadi is an absolutely amazing husband and father. Even, of course, my own family, when all of this started, said, oh my gosh, I can't believe you're married. It'll never work out. Marriage is hard enough when the people are from the same culture.
Right.
You're from two opposite ends of the spectrum. You're from two different worlds. This will never work. And of course, you've got people calling you, I knew someone who married a man from the Middle East and he stole her children. And another one married a man from the Middle East and he beats her. And it was just amazing. This is just coming out of the woodwork. And I had no idea, you know, how much, you know, bigotry was within my own family.
Did they turn around your family?
Oh my gosh, they did a complete 180. Mm-hmm. They love Fadi. Fadi's amazing. My dad, of course, was one of, you know, he's a Southern, you know, good old boy. And when he heard that his daughter was going to be marrying an Iraqi, was not a pretty sight. He and Fadi are like best friends now.
That's great.
It's amazing. They love each other.
Are there any cultural, maybe not conflicts, but cultural differences that come to the fore now?
Well, another irony, of course. One of the first things people ask me when they discover mm-hmm. I'm married to an Iraqi, did you have to convert to Islam? How was that? Are you raising your children, you know, Muslim? And the first thing it's like, yes, I actually did have to convert to Catholicism. I was raised agnostic, and Fadi is actually Catholic, born and raised Catholic. He's one of the 3% Christian minority in Iraq. So I actually did convert to Catholicism when we got married.
It's interesting how we make assumptions based on very limited knowledge.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Well, you have another book that's upcoming in 2017, Voicing the Eagle. And I understand that it's Fadi's story as a young interpreter for the U.S. military. Would you like to give us a teaser?
Sure. I'm probably more proud of writing his story than ours. Fadi has an absolutely amazing story. He has done so much for this country and, of course, in his country in turn. He was literally taken right off of his neighborhood street to become a translator.
That's amazing.
Right after the fall of Saddam, a couple of weeks after, you know, the liberation of Baghdad, a U.S. convoy rolled into his neighborhood. Mm-hmm. He was an upper middle class college boy. He was attending mm-hmm. the University of Baghdad, majoring in English. And the neighborhood he lived in was known to also be where government officials in Baghdad lived as well. So it was a hot spot for the military at the time. They were going in, going house to house, making sure there wasn't, you know, anybody stockpiling weapons. Of course, they were still looking for the weapons of mass destruction. Right. They might have been in somebody's backyard at the time for all they knew. So a convoy rolled into his neighborhood, and leave it to us to roll into a neighborhood and forget to bring anybody who speaks the language. The convoy had nobody with them that spoke Arabic. Pretty much nobody in the neighborhood spoke English. They're going house to house, residential houses, clearing them with weapons. They're patting down the women.
And without language.
Without, they're not able to communicate, of course. And of course, the soldiers, they weren't doing anything wrong
right.
by our standards. But of course, they were, you know, looking at the women. They were touching the women to the Iraqi men there in Baghdad. It was not appropriate. There was tension building between this unit and the residents. And of course, everybody standing outside their front door, looking at the military, the Americans, you know, going house to house. So it's this big spectacle. Right. Fadi's seeing it happen. He's seeing the tension building. The commander of the unit, an army captain, he saw the tension building. He knew things were not going to get pretty. Of course, everybody's armed. The Iraqis all have AKs in their houses. The last thing Fadi wanted was a firefight in his neighborhood between the Americans. And the army captain literally started walking down the street screaming, "Does anybody here speak English? Does anybody speak English?" He was desperate.
And he stepped up.
And Fadi, he didn't want to. He really didn't want to. He's like, "Oh, I don't want to get in the middle of this." But he knew that it was his duty. He knew nobody else in the area spoke English.
The reluctant translator.
He was the reluctant translator. Yeah. Maybe that should be the name of the book. So he went, he helped that unit for that day clear the neighborhood. And the captain looked at him and said, "You want to work for us? Because we'd really like you to come work for us." So Fadi said, "Sure." For the next year, he worked with that army unit in Baghdad, and then he went on to work for marine units throughout Al Anbar province. He was present for the Battle of Fallujah after the horrible Blackwater murders. He's been injured. He's suffered several combat injuries. He helped translate for the drill instructors in Ramadi who were training the new Iraqi army, the American drill instructors, you know, when we were training them. And then, of course, he worked his way up to the INIS. And along the way, he suffered a broken arm after his Humvee he was riding in was struck by an RPG and flipped. He was actually shot in the chest he took an AK-47 bullet to the chest. Luckily, he was wearing body armor, mm-hmm. but it still results in a pretty nasty injury. So, I mean, he spent years fighting alongside our Marines, our soldiers, leading with them, befriending them. He was, you know, he's probably one of the few people who can say he wore a Marine and Army uniform in Iraq. And of course, this all happened before we had met. So fast forward a few years when I'm being told that I'm this horrible person for being with Fadi.
Right.
After everything he had done for us, for our country, for our military, it was really a big slap in the face.
Must have felt like a betrayal to him.
It was. It felt like a betrayal to him. He understood, though. He does. Even when he immigrated here, we lived in a small, we started off in a rural Ohio town. If he would have to speak Arabic on his cell phone at the local Walmart, he'd get the sideways glances. And I, of course, was right there. I was the pit bull. You know, how dare you? You know, mm-hmm. And he would be the one, no, it's fine. You know, I totally understand. It's not a big deal.
Sounds like a very special person.
He is. He really is a special person. He's one of those people that could go anywhere.
Well, with your perspective and the peaceful life you're living now and everything that you know and you've experienced, in your opinion, was it a mistake, the Iraqi war?
This is a question everybody asks us.
Sorry.
No. No, honestly, it's a question everybody asks us. And it's a question that some of the most brilliant military strategists and some of the most brilliant academic minds around the world still struggle to answer. And we don't even begin to think we know the answer. Overall, looking at it, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. From a bird's eye perspective, there are more people suffering in Iraq today than there were before the fall of Saddam. But there were a great deal suffering under Saddam. So do you say that their suffering is okay? When we went in there, our intentions were good. Yes, a lot of people say at the upper echelons, we only went in there for oil or for whatever reason. Those of us on the ground went in there to help.
Right.
We were there to help. We wanted to help. And we made a mess of it. We really did. But I've learned, I studied political science after I got out. I did get my degree. And looking at it, you know, from that standpoint, you cannot force feed democracy.
Right.
To a society.
Yeah, the question's complicated, the answer's complicated.
Yeah, you can't do it. Revolution really has to come from within. You can't manufacture a successful revolution. And any revolution is going to be bloody. Look at Syria.
Are you employed now or are you a stay-at-home mom?
I am employed. I work full-time as a marketing coordinator for a local travel company in El Cajon. And Fadi works as a real estate agent. We're doing the cookie cutter lifestyle now.
I know.
It's amazing how you can go from working for a national intelligence service to a real estate agent. They're really similar. But yeah, so we're living the cookie cutter lifestyle and we're enjoying it. I definitely think I'm a person that has to work outside the home at least some.
Well, one last question, Amanda. What are you writing next after Fadi's story?
I really need to finish that one.
Okay, one at a time.
One at a time. I really don't have anything right now that I'm currently thinking after that one. I am focused fully on that one. And once that one gets done, maybe something in the future. But as of now, I write stories. I don't sit around saying, oh, what am I going to write next? It comes to me and say, I have to write this.
Okay, fair enough. Well, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
For more information on Amanda Matty and her books, please visit her website at amandamatty.com. And her last name is spelled MATTI.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.